It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. This morning, we continue our series of interviews with candidates running for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District seat, which covers the southeastern part of the state. The seat is currently held by House Speaker Paul Ryan, who is retiring. Today, we're talking with Brian Stile, the Republican candidate in the race for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Brian is an attorney and serves on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. Brian, welcome to the Morning Show.
John, thanks for having me on.
Why are you running for Congress?
I'm running because I think Washington needs problem solvers, people that go in and address problems head on, have open, honest conversations, and get things done. My background's in manufacturing and education. I think there's a real opportunity to take that skill set and background to Washington to work to lower the cost of health care, you know, increase wages and high-wage jobs for individuals here in southeast Wisconsin, and in particular with the background on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, prepare workers, you know, for the jobs of the future. Make sure that we have affordable, effective universities, technical schools, and strong high schools. And so that's what gets me up in the morning and gets me out the door on this race, running for Congress and talking to folks.
For better or worse, a lot of people see this not as a race to elect a new congressperson, but as a race to replace the current occupant of the seat, House Speaker Paul Ryan, who's retiring. So I think a lot of voters want to know, with you, are they getting a new candidate with new ideas or another Paul Ryan?
As I look at this race, everybody brings their own background to the table. I think my background's unique to me, unique to everyone in the race, and unique to Paul Ryan. And so, you know, I've worked for the past 10 years in the private sector for local manufacturing companies here in Rock County. I've been on the front line of decisions of addressing how do we lower the cost of health care and working towards high-wage jobs here in my home community of Janesville and across Rock County. And my work on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, I think that brings something new to the table, a true background in education, working hard to figure out how do we have affordable, effective universities and technical schools across this state to make sure that the workers are prepared for the jobs of the future and really able to try to move up that career ladder and to take advantage of some of these higher wage jobs that are coming to southeast Wisconsin.
Well, let's talk about the economy. On your website, you say that we need to restore fiscal discipline to the budget process while also continuing pro-growth policies to unleash the full strength of the American economy. What does that look like to you?
I think Washington has a taxing problem, not a spending. It has a spending problem, not a taxing problem. And so I look at what's going on in Washington and say we need to get our spending under control, and we need to keep a tax policy in place that encourages investment, which ultimately encourages higher wage jobs. I look at the tax reforms that were passed previously. I think that's a positive step in the right direction. I think that encourages investment, which ultimately leads to higher wages for workers here in southeast Wisconsin. I think the fact that we've got unemployment below 3%, we're at the beginning of starting to see higher wage jobs come into the area. We need to continue down that path and continue to put in economic policies that encourage investment, which ultimately leads to higher wage jobs. What we can't do is afford to take a step back to the failed economic policies of the past, and that's what I'm out talking to voters about every day.
You mentioned the tax cuts, and along with that, we have what some are calling a ballooning federal deficit. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell recently said the only way to lower that deficit would be to cut social safety net programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's something that Paul Ryan had talked about doing as well. Is that something that you're willing to accept?
As I look at Medicare and Social Security, those are promises we made to seniors. Those are promises we need to keep. There should be no changes in particular as it relates to individuals that are in retirement or approaching retirement age. As you look to that generation much further down, my generation and younger, it's an approach of how do we pull together a bipartisan review to determine how can we make these programs sustainable for future generations. But for the generation that's in retirement and approaching retirement age, we don't need to cut or negatively impact those individuals. Those are promises we made and promises we need to keep. And part of that is why I'm so focused on government spending across the board, is to make sure that our spending's in line so that we can honor that promise that we made to seniors, for those in particular in retirement now and approaching retirement age.
We're talking with Brian Stile, the Republican candidate in the 1st Congressional District, on The Morning Show as we continue our series of candidate interviews. Let's talk about health care. During the last session, we saw a failed attempt at repealing the Affordable Care Act, followed by changes to the law. In your view, what needs to happen with that law and with health care in general?
We need to lower the cost of health care. And so what the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare did was drive up the cost of health care and made health care less affordable and thus less accessible to hardworking families here in Wisconsin. What we need to do is work towards a program of health care that puts individuals and doctors in charge of the decision-making process so that they can increase quality and lower the cost of health care. I think that stands in stark contrast to my opponent, who supports a government takeover of healthcare called Medicare for All, in his words. And as I look at that program, that's going to drive up the cost of healthcare. And just to pay for that program alone, you'd have to, it would be a $32 trillion with a T dollar program. To conceptualize what that means, just to pay for that one program, you would have to double, that's double, all income and business taxes in the United States of America. That's a program we can't afford. And I think that would really decimate Medicare as we know it. It would make most people's private insurance that they receive from their employer illegal, and that's the wrong direction. What we need to do is stay focused on how do we lower the cost of health care, and you do that by putting patients and doctors in the forefront of the decision-making process.
How do patients with pre-existing conditions factor into all of this?
That's a great question, and there's a lot of confusion on that point. Individuals with pre-existing conditions need to be protected and need to be covered. I've been clear on that since day one. And so you can go in and address the disaster that is Obamacare, but still at the same time protect people with pre-existing conditions. So any changes to that law, first and foremost for me to earn my vote on that, we would need to protect individuals with pre-existing conditions. And then separate of that is how do you go in and address the cost structure that's driving up the cost of health care? And that's where I think we need to move away from a one-size-fits-all government answer and move into individuals and doctors making those health care decisions.
Bringing it back to Wisconsin, what do you think is one of the biggest issues affecting your district, and how would you work to tackle it in Congress?
In particular, I look at how do we prepare workers for the jobs of the future. What we're seeing in southeast Wisconsin, in particular along the I-94 corridor from the airport to the state line, is really significant job growth. And what we see now is a larger skills gap. We have more job openings than we have people that are unemployed. So that says we have a skills gap to make sure that individuals have the skills they need to be ready to go into the workforce to earn a higher wage. And so as I look at the federal government, using my background on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, there's a real opportunity to move the decision-making from Washington back to local educators, back to your local school board, back to the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, back to your technical college board. And as those individuals are able to make decisions best capable to prepare workers here in our economy, not bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., I think that's at the forefront of what needs to be at the next step now that we've got the economy moving along at the rate we do. We need to close this skills gap.
Well, this is your district is the district that we'll call Foxconn home, a company that received billions of dollars in state tax incentives to locate there. As a result, there are some mixed feelings about the company's presence in southeastern Wisconsin. So as the district's representative, what can you do to ensure that the state receives a good return on its investment?
We need to put in policies in place that encourage businesses to continue expanding and opening in this area and driving wages higher. And so what we're getting is competition for workers across southeast Wisconsin, and Foxconn's a big piece of that puzzle. And the result of that is we're starting to see the beginning of higher wages. And what we want to do is continue down that path where employers are fighting for the best workers, and what that will do is drive up the wages of those individuals. And as we see wage growth, we're going to see continued economic benefits for workers across the state. And so I think the more we put in place economic policies that encourage growth, encourage businesses to come to Wisconsin and invest here, that drives wage growth and drives job opportunities for workers and folks all across southeast Wisconsin. And to me, that's front and center of what needs to be done on behalf of workers here in Wisconsin.
We're just about out of time, Brian. America is a divided country right now. Congress is no exception to that. We've seen a lot of hyper-partisanship, votes strictly along party lines. What role do you see for a bipartisanship in Congress?
I think my background of having never run for office before, I've never run for office. The last time I ran for anything was in the seventh grade in middle school. So, I mean, I think there's an opportunity to take my private sector background and put it to work to get things done. Same way you approach that on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. There were folks that were appointed by Governor Walker and by Governor Doyle. And folks on the Board of Regents, we figured out how do we work together to put students first. If we took that same approach and applied it to Washington and said, how do we work together to get more done on behalf of the American people? I think there's a Wisconsin style of communication that I can bring to the table. And it's less about who gets credit. It's more about how do we get more done on behalf of the American people. And I think my private sector background combined with my work on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents really prepares me to be able to bring people together to the table to say, how do we get more done and how do we get less bickering going on in Washington?
Brian Steil is an attorney and serves on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. He's the Republican candidate in the race for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Brian, thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Farming is one of the most dangerous professions you can get into. It's certainly a tough way to make a living, and farmers in rural Wisconsin often struggle with access to health care due to a lack of providers, distance to facilities, and the unaffordability of health insurance. The Rural Health Initiative was formed in 2004 to address some of those barriers, and we'll talk with its executive director about the components of the program and how it's expanding. Do you live in rural Wisconsin? If so, does that impact your ability to access health care? Are you a farmer? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting to the doctor's office? Have you used the services of the Rural Health Initiative, and what was that experience like? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rhonda Strable is the Executive Director of the Rural Health Initiative. Rhonda, good morning. Welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us about the Rural Health Initiative and the concept of kitchen wellness.
Yeah, the idea of kitchen wellness really came from the farm women. When we thought of this idea, and this started back in 2003 when a group of people from CHAT, Community Health Action Team, a group of people spearheaded by ThetaCare, Northeast Wisconsin Health System, that said, you know, they noticed that the only time we really saw our farmers were when they were coming in through the emergency room. And the emergency doctors thought, boy, if we could have just saw some of these people earlier without that big heart attack, that big stroke, that big diabetic episode, if we could have just caught them sooner and we could have prevented this. So there was a group of people that look at how they can help outside the walls of their clinics and hospitals, how they can improve the health of their community. And there was a group of people that went on a plunge, which is just an adult field trip from this group, and they went out and saw a day in the life of a farmer. And they saw, you know, what they deal with, dealing with the long hours and the hard work ethic that they have, but dealing with the stress of weather, the stress of the pricing, the commodity pricing, the price of health care, the distance, just on and on. There's so many issues, so many barriers that prevent farmers from coming in. And so they came back, and there were a group of farm women that we gathered together, and we said, how can we help get your farmers, your husbands in? And through a lot of discussion, finally one of the farm women said, you know, we really appreciate your kindness, but they said, you're just not going to get our husbands in. Unless you come to the farm, you're just not going to see them. And there was a retired cardiologist in the room, Dr. John Milkey, and he said, why can't we? Why can't we bring health care to the farm? why do we think that they should change their way of living to come in for services? Because if you think about it, everything else comes to the farm. The veterinarian comes to the farm. The fuel, the feed, their supplies get delivered to the farm. But yet we wait for them to come to healthcare. And so that was where the idea was born. It was sort of an off-the-cuff comment from a farm woman that just said, you know, you're just not going to get them in. They're not going to take the time away. So then when we had this idea, we said, well, what are we going to do about it? So we formed the Rural Health Initiative in Shawnee County, and we said, let's just give it a try. Let's pilot it for 3 years and see if we can make any type of impact. And so that was when I was hired in January 2004. And I have a farming background, so that really helped because they weren't even really sure how I was going to get to the farm or explain what we would like to do. And I thought, well, who came to our farm when I was growing up? So I started riding along with the route drivers and the veterinarians and the milkmen. And I would just ride along and jump out of their truck and say, you know, do you need your blood pressure taken? And, you know, I can come back tomorrow if you fast. I can come back and we can check your cholesterol and your blood sugars. We can do this right here on the farm. And that's where our kitchen wellness idea was born. Was it's amazing how important the kitchen table is. Because if you think about it, it's the place where we talk about the important things in life. We talk about our family. We talk about our health. We talk about our finances. Usually when we want to have a big discussion, we sit down at the kitchen table. And so we said, this is kitchen wellness. We're bringing it right to the kitchen table. And let's talk about the health, you know, issues that you may or may not be having. But let's make sure you know your numbers. So that's where it started in 2004.
You mentioned checking blood pressure, doing some blood testing for cholesterol levels. What other services are offered during these home visits?
Yeah, so what we do is they know that we're coming, so we have a great turnout rate, right? We don't have any no-shows. So when we come to their table, we sit down with them and have them fill out an assessment, which is it's a health risk assessment, asking them questions about their health and their behaviors. And then we do a simple blood draw, and it tells us their total lipid panel, which is their total cholesterol, their good and their bad cholesterol, their triglycerides, and their glucose. We do their height and their weight, which then also gives us their body mass index, which we say BMI, and we also do their body fat analysis. We take their blood pressure, and this can all be done. We get the results. We get instant results of their blood test within 10 minutes. But that's really where the magic happens. When you can explain to someone, this is what your number should be, and this is what your number is. Just very, you know, it's not accusing, it's just, it is what it is. And then from there, we can do health coaching, health education. We can set goals with an individual. We can see if they can start making some lifestyle changes, because that's the ultimate goal, is if we can prevent them from having, becoming a diabetic, for instance, you know, that's a great place to catch them before they get it or in the early stages, that they can reverse it. We also can do an A1C, which is a more diagnostic test for diabetes. But once it gets above that level, once we detect that they may have a serious condition, really they do need to see a healthcare provider. And typically then they'll go, if they know that there's something wrong, they will go for care, and they're also very compliant with their providers. So that's really great. They know that they don't have time to be sick. The problem is they don't think about think that anything's wrong, because as long as they can get up every day and work and just go about their business, they think they're just fine. But in actuality, when we sit down at their table and we do their testing, 52% of the time we find something acute, something that they didn't know they had that could potentially turn out to be something serious.
So how does the service get paid for? Do the people who are receiving their service pay anything? Where does the funding come from?
Yeah, so the funding is a tricky part. From the very beginning, we didn't want cost to be a barrier to the farmers. Farmers are self-employed, self-insured. They don't share their insurance cost with others. They're not involved in group plans. They also live and work in the same environment, which is considered the number one most riskiest occupation. And so their rates are often very high. So what they'll do, their premiums are very, very, very expensive. And that is often with a high deductible of at least $5,000, sometimes a $10,000 deductible. So that's one of their barriers of why they don't come in. They're already paying high cost, but then they're also have this barrier of the high deductible. So really, why would they go in if they don't think anything is wrong, right? So and if they do come in for a preventive health screening, they're going to have to pay out of pocket. So for us, we didn't want to have to charge, and very often farmers don't qualify for programs because they have too much stuff, you know, the appreciation of...
Rhonda, we're going to have to hold that thought and come back and pick this up in just a moment. Our conversation continues. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. We're talking with Rhonda Strable, Executive Director of the Rural Health Initiative, about the challenges Wisconsin farmers face in getting health care and how her organization is working to change that. Do you live in rural Wisconsin? If so, does that impact your ability to access health care? Are you a farmer? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting to the doctor's office? And have you used the services of the Rural Health Initiative? What was that experience like? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rhonda, just before the news, we were talking about what the program costs and who picks up the tab. And you said that the idea was that, you didn't want the farmers to have to pay. So where does the money come from?
Yeah, so the money comes from our community. It is 100% community supported. We are a small nonprofit organization, so we take funds from anyone that will contribute, including our farmers if they do want to make a contribution, but they're not charged a fee at this time. For 15 years, we have not had to charge a fee. I can't guarantee that that's always going to be that way, but right now how we've been supported is people in our community. Healthcare, the ThetaCare and Ascension healthcare systems have been involved. Our agribusinesses have been great partners. We have a number of agribusinesses that support the initiative, our local banks, our local family foundations, individuals. We put on fundraisers. To be honest with you, 75% of my time is spent fundraising to keep the program sustained. And so it's a lot of work to keep these services coming to our farms, but we really believe in our community that it's that important to keep our farm families healthy and safe. And we're the only ones out there doing this type of work where we're making sure and bringing health care to our farm families. And so far, through our board of directors and myself, we have been able to keep it funded without asking the farmers to pay for services. Now, farming has changed a lot. When I first started 15 years ago, it was mostly all the mom-and-pop type of operations. And we still go to family farms, but a lot of the farms that we're going to now are much larger, and these large dairies with workers, it's almost becoming more of a worksite wellness program where we take an interpreter along. So now when we go to the large dairies, we do ask the large dairies to help fund and offset our costs. But for the most part, we have not asked our farmers to contribute for the first 15 years of this program.
This program started in Shawano County. How has it expanded?
Yeah, it started in Shawano County, and about 8 years into the program, Outagamie and Waupaca counties, our neighbors to the south, inquired about how they could also address the concerns of their rural population. Because as we look at our county health rankings of each of our counties, we often take care of our bigger cities, you know, whether it's the Fox Cities or Shawano or Madison. We always tend to have a lot of really great resources within our cities, but we often forget about our whole county or our rural population. So as they were looking at their county health rankings, they really recognized that they were really missing the rural population, and this is a group of people that they were not addressing. So they came to us and said, you know, would you be willing to expand your program to service the three counties? And since 2012, we've been doing that. We've expanded to three counties. They are in northeast Wisconsin, and they are within the funding area where we already have agribusinesses and where we already have the healthcare systems. So it was sort of a natural fit. We did try to move over one county west to Marathon County, but with it being central Wisconsin, it was difficult for us to do funding there. We can teach the program anywhere in the state or anywhere in the country. We know how to do this work. The issue is that particular community needs to find its own revenue source. So, you know, it really needs to come from within.
So that's kind of what would need to happen for this to become a statewide effort, is that each county would need to figure out how to raise the money to pay for it?
It really would. That's the tricky part of the program, is how to keep it funded. A misconception many might have is that they think that there's government or federal funding or state or county funding. There is actually $0 that come from the government in any way, including our local, you know, county. This is all 100% community supported. You know, a great option would be for the healthcare systems to say, in any community, say, we're willing to take this on because it is that important. So it could be, you know, one healthcare system that says, we want to do this for our whole service area, that it's worth the amount. So wherever the funding comes from, it can happen in many different places or different ideas. For us, particularly in Shawano, Outagamie, and Wapaka counties, Theta Care has been a great supporter, but it hasn't been 100%. They've actually been 32%. So we still need to raise the other, you know, 58% of the funding from our community through fundraisers and through donations and sponsorships through other organizations, such as the agribusinesses.
What's your relationship been like with the main healthcare providers in the three counties that you serve?
As far as the healthcare providers, the doctors, as far as those providers, they have been fantastic. They're very much on board. We work in collaboration with each other, where we refer clients in because we're detecting things. And then every once in a while, they'll have a farm person that comes in for something else, and they say, oh, we should do this type of testing. And they'll say to the farmer, well, why don't we have the Rural Health Initiative come out to help save some money so that that you don't have to have it in the office. So we work in tandem. As far as insurance, you know, often people have said, well, why couldn't the insurance companies help with this? Couldn't they contribute? It would be great if they would contribute financially to the program, because we are on the front end working on prevention. This is all about prevention. And it would be better to help on the front end to prevent something happening rather than at the end when it's pretty catastrophic, once the big episode of a heart attack, stroke, or, you know, diabetes happens. As far as insurance, every farmer has a different insurance company. So they're all self-employed, and you know, to find that one provider to say, you know, oh, we'll support this program is, you know, it's been almost impossible for us. So,
well, we know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, so that certainly
absolutely
would seem to be the case here. So I guess that leads to the question, and we're running out of time here, but what kind of outreach does the Rural Health Initiative do to encourage healthy behavior in rural Wisconsin?
The first thing is knowing your numbers. So we want our clients to know, our farmers to know, what their blood pressure, what their cholesterol, and what their blood sugar levels are. Then we want them to be educated on the simple things that they can do, reducing sugary beverages, eating more fruits and vegetables, eating less, weighing less, feeling better, Each year we focus in on one educational piece, and we're trying to help our farmers live healthier lifestyles, both in their health and well-being and also in safety.
And where can our listeners go if they're interested, either if they're in your service area, they're interested in getting care through the Rural Health Initiative, or if they want to help out? Where can they go for more information about your organization?
They can go to our website, which is wiruralhealth.org. We have a website page. We also have a Facebook page underneath the Rural Health Initiative. Or you can call me at 715-524-1488. I'm located in Shawano, but we do contract services with outside the area of our three service county. So we would come to a large dairy in Mosinee or in Dean County. We would come and do those services for a fee, but you can contact us at those locations.
Okay, Rhonda Strable, Executive Director of the Rural Health Initiative, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. As part of WPR's ongoing election coverage, we're featuring interviews with candidates on the 2018 midterm ballot. This week, we're talking with candidates for Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. U.S. Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner represents that district now. He's a Republican who's represented this district since 1978 and is running for his 21st term. As a member of Congress, he serves on the Foreign Affairs and Judiciary Committees. His opponent in this election is Democrat Tom Pulsevich. Congressman Sensenbrenner, welcome to the Morning Show, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, John, thank you very much for having me. I look forward to having a good discussion.
Well, yeah. Well, let's start with this one then. You've spent most of your career in the House of Representatives. Why are you running for a 21st term?
Well, there are a lot of things that we still have left to do in this country, and it's important that Wisconsin have some seniority in the House of Representatives, particularly since Speaker Paul Ryan has announced his retirement and won't be back in the next Congress. I provide that seniority, and I have worked in a bipartisan way and have been effective. And some nonpartisan rating services have said that I rank very high in terms of bipartisanship and in terms of getting important bills passed into law. I think the most important thing that we can do under the jurisdiction of the committees that I am on is to continue the fight against opioid abuse. And we need to plug a loophole in our current criminal laws where there are no statutory criminal penalties against the importation and sale of fentanyl analogs, which in many cases are more deadly than fentanyl, which is a pretty deadly drug to begin with. So I want to go back to Washington. I want to work at dealing with this public health emergency that has struck practically everybody in some way or another, and to be able to get a handle on these overdoses and deal with education, deal with treatment of people who are addicted, as well as providing various antidotes to first responders.
You mentioned Paul Ryan stepping down. He's Speaker of the House. How is this going to impact GOP leadership in Congress?
Well, we're going to have a pretty wild leadership election of those people who have been elected on November 6th. I would say that the current favorite is Kevin McCarthy of California, who is the current majority leader. However, unlike party positions like majority and minority leader in the whips organization, the speaker is elected by the entire House. And both McCarthy as well as Nancy Pelosi on the Democratic side, there are a number of candidates who have said that they would not vote for that candidate of their own party if they were elected. I would guess that the next House of Representatives is going to be very narrowly divided. And if neither McCarthy nor Pelosi can get 218 votes of all the representatives that were elected in November, then there's going to be a dark horse that is going to end up winning the Speaker's election.
So the Republicans in Congress have, let's talk about health care for a little bit. Republicans in Congress have made several attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Is that still a priority?
Well, for me, it's a priority because the Affordable Care Act has not been affordable. People have seen premiums jump. Some people have been able to retain their doctors, but most of them have not been. And this goes directly against what then-President Obama promised when the Affordable Care Act was under debate in Congress about 8 or 9 years ago. I want to emphasize that every proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare protects people with pre-existing conditions. I'll qualify that. Proposals that have had serious discussion and serious debate. There are a couple of those that completely do away with the pre-existing conditions protections, but there is no proposal that I would support that does away with the pre-existing conditions exception, because practically everybody has gotten sick from about the age of 5 on, and we should not let insurance companies use that as an excuse to deny coverage.
Let's talk about the budget, because that's certainly a huge item that Congress has to deal with. Recently, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the only way to lower the federal deficit would be to cut social safety net programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Is that something you'd be willing to accept?
Well, let's define cut the way cut actually works. Nobody, including Senator McConnell, are proposing actually reducing benefits below what they are now. What the proposal is to reduce the growth rate of benefits. And that is going to be really essential, because as more and more baby boomers retire and more baby boomers live longer, we are going to see the cost of these social safety programs balloon. And pretty soon we're not going to have much money to do anything else besides pay for the social safety programs. So, you know, I keep on telling people that, you know, if we really want to continue having support for programs like Medicare and Social Security of younger people, the younger people are going to have to be assured that there will be something left for them compensate them for the huge amount of taxes that they will be paying into the program during their working years. So how this is resolved is important, not only for the older generation, where I will repeat, nobody is saying that we ought to cut that. We just ought to slow the growth rate down, and the younger generation that is paying for it.
Let's move to another topic. The last Congress left behind a lot of unanswered questions on the topic of immigration. As a result, that issue will likely be front and center when next Congress convenes. Both parties agree that something needs to be done, but there's a lot less agreement on what that should actually look like. What would be your approach?
Well, I tried to do something back in 2005 and 2006, and had I succeeded in that, there are a lot of people that said we wouldn't be talking about this issue now. What we need to do is, number one, secure the border. And that's going front and center with this caravan that is moving through Mexico now. Number two, we have to turn off the magnet that draws people across the border. And that is bad employers breaking the law to hire illegal immigrants and pay them in cash under the table, and they violate, you know, a dozen or so laws, but as long as they're able to get away with it, they keep on doing it. And the third thing is to never, never, never grant amnesty to illegal immigrants. Back in 1986, there were even political liberals of the day, like Father Hesburgh, late of Notre Dame University, that said if we give amnesty to illegal immigrants, we will only encourage more illegal immigration. President Reagan signed the amnesty bill. Reagan was wrong. Father Hesburgh was right on this. And we had between 3 and 3.5 million illegal immigrants at the time. Now we have somewhere between 11 and 20 million illegal immigrants. My fear is that if we get amnesty in another 20 years, we're going to have another immigration crisis with 40 million illegal immigrants here. And our country cannot support that economically. We do need to address the issue of labor shortages in this country. And the way to do that is to reform legal immigration to allow people who work in various industries like agriculture, temporary visas so that they can come and work and keep the economy going and keep affordable food on our table. But that doesn't mean it should be at the cost of amnestying millions of people, because it's wrong if you broke the law, and it's wrong if you have the amnesty people jump ahead of those that have applied for legal immigration status to jump ahead of them in line.
We've talked about a lot of topics, and you've worked a lot on, we mentioned the Opioid Abuse Reduction Act, which you worked on. What else are you working on that you think is really vitally important to members, citizens of the 5th District?
Well, I think the so-called SOFA Act, which we've talked about earlier, which basically criminalizes the fentanyl analogs, that has got to be the top issue. Because if we crack down on regular fentanyl, you're just going to see the drug cartels and the pushers push the analogs. And they're more deadly than fentanyl, which is deadly. Now, the other thing I think we have to work on is school safety. And there the federal government can provide money, but the decisions on how to implement that will have to actually be done by locally elected school boards. Finally, we're having unprecedented prosperity. You know, we've got more jobs available than they're unemployment, than they're unemployed, both in Wisconsin and nationally. That's good, and we're now beginning to see increases in take-home pay. You know, that's the kind of prosperity that benefits everybody, not just people in the 5th District, but all throughout our country. And we ought to keep that moving by making the tax cuts permanent and making sure that we don't go back and re-regulate the profit out of American manufacturing. That's regulating the profit out of American manufacturing is basically the other side's outsourcing program, where American jobs get outsourced to places like China and India.
Congress seems to grow more polarized after each election. If reelected, how would you work with your colleagues across the aisle?
Well, the problem is that a lot of these independent groups that are flooding the TV with ads like to be the ideological police, both against Democrats and Republicans who attempt to reach bipartisan solutions. So reaching across the aisle is something that doesn't have to be publicized, but has to be done. And I'm one of the people that's done it. The Comprehensive Addiction and Reduction Act, where I was the principal House sponsor of, that was reaching across the aisle. The Voting Rights Act reauthorization was reaching across the aisle. But I wasn't batting my gums on cable TV announcing that that was what I was doing. I was just spending my time getting the thing done, getting the votes to pass the bill, and then getting the Senate to move on something, which isn't the easiest thing in the world to do, to get the bill passed through the Senate and put on the president's desk.
Congressman, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this
morning.
Thank you
very much. Have a good
U.S.
day.
Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner represents Wisconsin's 5th District. And I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.